Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello, everyone. This is Risky Business on risky.biz, and I'm Patrick Gray. This week's podcast is brought to you by Message Labs and hosted, as always, by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting at discounted rates, too. So thank you, guys. On this week's show, we're going to hear some audio from a hearing in the US House of Representatives. I'll be playing excerpts from the Subcommittee on Emerging Threats, Cybersecurity, and Science and Technology, which posed the question, do the payment card industry data standards reduce cybercrime? Now, I listened to the whole lot, so you wouldn't have to, and I'll never have that time back again. So I pulled out about 20 minutes of the more interesting testimony and comments, and that's coming up later for your listening pleasure. Now, if you haven't checked out our new site, which is at risky.biz, this week we've got a great piece up there from MetalStorm, his latest, which is very funny. I'll tell you about that in a minute. And also a piece that I wrote for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, or ABC. Now, in that piece, I basically blamed the prevalence of malware on banks. Now, that might sound a bit weird, but if you go and read it, it could possibly make sense. Now, we've also got an interview in Risky Business 2 that was uploaded a couple of days ago. Now, that's with the CEO of Palo Alto Networks, Mr. Lane Bess. And as I said earlier, yeah, MetalStorm's latest column is a fantastic read. In it, he basically argues that Unix systems are, these days, the kiss of death to enterprise security. Controversial stuff and a lot of fun, so I hope you enjoy it. Now, while you're there, please sign up for an account for your chance to win an EPC, courtesy of Kaspersky. We've also got a couple of TikiTag RFID readers and writers that I paid for out of my own pocket, and a few nifty little toolkits, courtesy of Microsoft. Big thanks to Kaspersky and Microsoft for donating the prizes, particularly Kaspersky, who came through with the EPC. It's worth about $700. To be eligible for the prizes, you must fill out all of the data when you sign up, including your employer and, you know, your job title and all that jazz. And you need to be in Australia or New Zealand. Sorry to our overseas listeners on that one. Now, yeah, we actually don't have SSL working on the site yet, and I'm aware of the irony, but it should be working in the next 48 hours. Sorry we've dragged our heels on that. Now, also in this week's episode, we'll be having a chat to Paul Wood from Message Labs in the UK, and we're discussing some of the more innovative features in malware these days. Paul's up to his armpits in this stuff 9 to 5, and normally, yeah, I find malware discussions a little bit boring, but there's definitely some good info in there, so stay tuned for that one. But first up, it's time for a check of this week's news headlines with securityassessment.com's Paul Craig. And Paul, I suppose we should start off with the big news of the week, which is that apparently the world has actually ended because Conficker activated on April Fool's Day. And, of course, the internet doesn't work anymore. It's terrible news.
I think that was an April Fool's, man.
But, I mean, you would agree that the media hysteria around this has been quite amazing.
It's been astronomical. I mean, Conficker was on 60 Minutes, was it, like last week in the US?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was even on bloody national radio this week talking about it, basically saying, well, nothing's really going to happen, and they still ran it, you know, in bloody national radio.
Yeah, I read a really good news article today that described Conficker as the Paris Hilton of worms.
Oh, that's
always
nice.
In the media. And I thought that was perfect. It's the Paris Hilton of worms.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. But, I mean, I suppose, look, we're recording this on April 1 here in Australia, and all we've really seen is it's actually going out and starting to compile a list of those 50,000 domains and maybe checking a few of them, but it's not really doing anything yet. I suppose that's to be expected. It's just moving into the next phase of infection.
Yeah.
Now, last year it was big news when McColo, which was a bulletproof hosting provider, got shut down and spam levels just dropped through the floor. But it's official. As of now, spam levels are back up to where they were at the time the plug was pulled on McColo.
Well, did you really think that pulling the plug on McColo was actually going to solve the problem?
Well, what I do find interesting, Paul, is that it actually did have such a severe impact, and it was a lasting impact, if we're talking about it six months later.
No, it decreased the amount of spam, but, I mean, if there's, it's like a supply and demand kind of thing. If there's a demand for something, there's going to be people out there trying to sell it. So all they did was have to find a new way of sending the email. They're not going to stop. I mean, just because you unplug their internet, you know, they're not just going to give up the spam business.
Well, it's funny you say that because at the time we had Kimberly Zenz of iDefense on the show saying basically, look, you know, we kind of liked it when they were hosting at McColo because we could watch what the bastards were up to. You know, we could actually have a little bit of decent intelligence. And now you know, since Mercola's been closed, you know, her prediction that you'd see a rise in sophistication of command and control structures for botnets, you know, has come true. And we've got a guy from Message Labs coming on a little bit later to discuss that. But you would agree that, you know, the days of just relying on hard-coded IP addresses for, you know, command and control via IRC or whatever, I mean, they're pretty much over because these guys can't rely on bulletproof hosting anymore.
Yes, definitely. I think the amount of money that these people must be making from these services means that they're going to look at this in the most technologically, you know, advanced way they can. That they're not, these are not kids messing around. This is a serious operation.
And I guess we've seen with Conficker already, it's got a peer-to-peer updating capability. It hasn't, to my knowledge, it hasn't been switched live yet, but it's clear they're thinking about that stuff and how to not have to rely on dodgy Russians hosting racks of badness. So interesting stuff anyway. Now, this next piece, you've got to give this little guy a bit of kudos for having a go, but a former teenage hacker, this story comes to us via Kevin Poulsen, who wrote it up for Wired. A former teenage hacker who served time in prison for an online stock trading scheme is back in jail after allegedly gaining administrative access to a New York-based currency exchange service and just giving himself $100,000.
Yeah, you think he would have learned from the first time he did it, when he used his own account, you know, give himself a whole lot of money, that he was doing it again. It's a bad idea. I mean, this guy is setting himself up to get busted, and shock, surprise, he does.
Yeah, well, what I find interesting is, you know, maybe he's been doing this for a long time, and this is just the one they caught him for.
Yeah, I mean, the details of this guy definitely has cojones. I mean, he gave himself $55,000 one day, and then the next day he gave himself another $55,000, but it was to a legitimate account. It was an account that he had set up previously. Then he just gave himself money. I mean, that's, I don't know if that's cojones or just stupidity.
Yeah, well, I mean, you might want to think that you'd maybe do a bit of a phishing attack, you know, get someone's account, transfer it into there, you know, maybe pull it out, Western Union it to your cousin in Kazakhstan or
something
like
exactly.
That.
Exactly. Be a little creative. You would make a much better criminal, Pat. Oh,
thank you. Thank you, Paul. But he, it looks like he's in a fair bit of trouble. He was already sentenced in 2004 over something else to 13 months in prison, followed by 3 years of supervised release. So, yeah, he's well and truly in the poo. But there you go. Those scams are still possible. You can just start breaking into currency exchanges and wiring yourself money. And, you know, if you're not a complete idiot, you might be able to get away with it too. So there you go. If you lose your job, something to consider in this down market. Now, this next piece has been a really quite a sensational one. I don't know that it's the research that it's based on is perhaps as robust as it should have been, but it looks reasonably solid, which is also courtesy of Wired, an electronic spy network that infiltrated the computers of government officers, NGOs, and activist groups in more than 100 countries has been stealing documents and eavesdropping on electronic correspondence, basically among pro-Tibet groups. And it looks like the people who did this research from the University of Toronto say that it's the Chinese government who's responsible for this eavesdropping exercise.
Yeah, well, they seem to have pointed the finger at the Chinese government, and they have some sort of, I'll call it kind of iffy facts regarding why they think it's the Chinese government. My personal take is that China has a lot of people, and in China there are a hell of a lot of really good hackers. I mean, we see some of the best skilled and the most ruthless hackers coming out of China. And this could very easily just be Chinese individuals that are working together in a group. Doesn't have to be the government.
Yeah, and I think the other thing too is that there are a lot of nationalists in China who aren't necessarily politically aligned with the pro-Tibet movement. Then again, you've got to ask what they would have to gain by doing this sort of passive eavesdropping on people. I mean, the specific bits of malware with Chinese interfaces have been found, and they did do some tracebacks to IPs that are located in the region where the government investigators who keep an eye on pro-Tibet guys is located. So there was a little bit more evidence there. But, I mean, it's creepy stuff anyway, undetectable Trojans being used. And the research paper is interesting in that it goes into precisely how these attacks were done. So they'd be able to intercept mail and then interfere with the attachments and insert malware, auto-executing malware, into attachments that went between two people from these pro-Tibet organizations. So they'd be sending each other a PowerPoint thing. Someone would actually intercept that in transit, stuff the PowerPoint presentation with malware and then let it continue. So
it
was a pretty sophisticated sort of hack, and you got to sort of wonder who else has the time to really be sitting around and doing that.
I guess I'm always a little skeptical of whenever the media jumps up and down and says the Chinese government are hacking everybody.
I used to be, Paul, the same, because I'd think, oh, what are they doing? Just, you know, IP addresses located in China. But from what some guys on the sort of spookier side of the business have told me, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that they have an extremely well-developed capability.
Oh, I'm skeptical. I'm a skeptic.
Oh, now in this next piece, it's made a bit of news around the world, is our current Minister for Broadband, Stephen Conroy, is trying to introduce a censorship regime to stop bad things coming down the intertubes and interfering with our sensitive little minds. And the some guys actually defaced, and I love a good defacement, you don't see nearly enough of them in, these days, they actually defaced the censorship board's homepage at classification.gov.au and put a fairly funny message up there.
And they blame China as well.
Yeah, they did. They said, we're part of an elaborate deception from China to control and sheepify the nation to protect the children. They ended their message with, come and join the space party. So I don't know that it was a terribly serious message. But you got to love this in terms of the civil disobedience factor, don't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, how do you feel about as an Australian citizen and your internet viewing ability is going to be impeded or monitored or, you know, sort of, don't you think that you should have the freedom, the right to look at what you want on the internet?
I don't think I should have the right to look at child pornography.
Well, they weren't just blocking child pornography. They were also blocking extreme violence.
Well, and herein lies my problem with the legislation. I mean, it was blocking everything from euthanasia sites to anti-abortion sites.
Poker sites, WikiLeaks entries.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, you know, online gambling is illegal in Australia, and until now, that's just meant that everyone goes to offshore sites. So I think, really, I don't think it's unreasonable for a government to expect to have some sort of censorship capability. The problem is that the government, what it's trying to force through now is they've got a really vague definition around what prohibited content is, and that is my worry. I mean, if they came out and put together some very specific legislation that said we are only going to target this type of material, then I think that would be okay. But it's all a little bit vague and all a little bit sort of wishy-washy, and then I don't like it. So as an Australian, as you asked, I don't like it. Right. But that said, I don't think that means we shouldn't have at least some sort of censorship capability for the worst of the worst. And it's not even because I think that that's going to stop people accessing child porn. But I think if you throw a barrier up and people have to start circumventing a filter using things like Tor or offshore SSL proxies or whatever,
it makes it harder.
It's not just that it makes it harder. It's that people know what they're doing. They're circumventing a control. They know they're stepping over the line.
So they know that it is actually wrong. It's bad that they shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah, and they know that we have taken steps to stop them from doing that, and they're doing it anyway. So, you know, I think it could be a valuable thing. But I got to say, I do love it that these guys actually managed to pwn the classification website and mess with it, because that's fun. I think it's a poignant statement saying that, you know, how can you expect that you will be able to censor us when you can't even secure the website of your classification board? So anyway, in this next piece, a little bit of depressing news for people based in Melbourne. The company formerly known as Computer Associates, CA, has cut 31 staff from its Melbourne R&D lab, and that would include a lot of malware analysts and whatnot.
Yeah, and you sort of have to wonder, I mean, with the sort of economic situation that we have, the amount of malware and the amount of hackers out there is actually going to increase. We're going to find there are more people trying to make money on the internet. So you would think that you would want to invest everything you can into security software. That's actually going to be our saving grace.
I'd hope so.
Yeah, but I guess obviously not in CA.
I mean, I think it's tough for any company operating in this sort of environment. When you get a slowdown, you're always looking to cut, and R&D is expensive, but you got to imagine that if they chose to then rebuild this R&D, their R&D facilities to the same extent to which they were operating before, it's going to cost them a lot of money. Hiring people is expensive, is I guess what I'm saying. Oh, now here's an interesting write-up from The Register, which has basically unpicked the origins of the myth that revenues from cybercrime exceed those from the global drug trade. So basically, the Reg has come out and said this is bullshit.
Yeah, I was actually at a conference last week in Melbourne. There was a vendor there that had big billboards, big signs saying cybercrime exceeds the drug trade, and there's more money lost in cybercrime. And I held him up about this. I was like, man, that doesn't sound right. And I'm sure the drug trade's bigger. I'm sure there's more money. But he couldn't back himself up. But yes, it's quite interesting this comes out now. I mean, the figures that they were stating are just vastly overstated. Like one person comes up with the $1 trillion figure, and then someone else kind of adds to it, and then it just grows way out of proportion. And then becomes every vendor's fear-mongering and scare tactic when they sell their software.
Yeah, it goes right into every PowerPoint slide, doesn't it?
Yeah. That's not true.
No, it's not. So Ed Amoroso, who's a Senior Vice President and Chief Security Officer at AT&T, told a congressional committee on 20th of March that cybercrime was a $1 trillion a year business. Written testimony from Amoroso actually repeated that claim, which was made before a hearing of the Senate Commerce, Science and Transportation Committee. So, yeah, it looks like this. We can at least source this back to AT&T and say, you know what, you're a pack of douchebags.
Thanks for spreading lies.
Yeah. Oh, well, at least we get to debunk them and call them douchebags. That's fun. Now, in this final piece, Paul, some stolen credit card numbers have been exposed via Google. Oops.
Yeah, oops. I think it's another classic case of the Google caching something they probably shouldn't have cached.
What was the credit card information of 19,000 Britons?
Yeah.
So it looked like it was exposed on Google search before being removed. Now, I know that you've had a bit of experience for digging some interesting stuff out of Google Cache, including some basically botnet records. Now, they contained some botnet. Yeah, they contained lots of credit cards and logins and stuff, and you pulled that right out of Cache, right?
Yeah, right out of the Cache. They were in the Google Cache for actually quite a while before Google removed them. It does actually look like, I suspect that Google have someone in-house, or at least one person, who's looking for this information which is being cached by Google. Because this always keeps popping up in the media. You know, Google caches something it shouldn't because someone has directory listings enabled on their web server when they shouldn't.
And the rest is history.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, you would really be surprised by what you'd find by searching for the first, say, 10 digits of your credit card online.
Mm.
Yeah.
So what's the solution here? I mean, does Google just need to be more vigilant in trying to identify, perhaps automatically, you know, number sequences that look like credit card data?
I don't think you can actually reliably do that. I mean, short of looking for, you know, like mod 10 numbers and what they're like, you won't cache any mod 10 number followed by a four-digit number, you won't. I think that's quite a technology thing. I mean, content can have lots and lots of different possible values, you know? I mean, I think more people need to become aware about what information they expose on their website. Google can't cache it because it's not available to begin with. I mean, the fact that someone actually had a website that was storing credit card numbers is bad to begin with, and that it was available in an internet-accessible text file or whatever. I mean, that's 1999 technique.
That seems to be just as popular as it used to be.
Yeah, people shouldn't be doing that.
Okay, so we should slap them on the head and not Google.
Yeah. I think you should. I don't think it's Google's fault that someone chooses to have really bad information on their website.
Okay. Well, Paul, that's the end of the news this week, mate. Thank you very much for popping along to join us.
Hey, no worries.
Paul Craig on the line from New Zealand there. Now, instead of running a feature interview this week, we're going to hear some of the testimony and comments from the US House of Representatives Subcommittee on Emerging Threats, Cybersecurity and Science and Technology. That hearing asked whether PCI is working, and as you'll hear, the overall impression, as far as the government's concerned, seems to be that it is not working. I mean, recently we heard, regular listeners to the show would know that we heard that the Reserve Bank of Australia came out and said that card-not-present fraud in Australia is up 50% on 1 year ago, which is a pretty staggering figure. Now, there's some great stuff in this recording from an angry merchant, which is fun, and also from, you know, various politicians. But look, this is important stuff with some pretty big implications for the industry, which is why I've included it this week. I'll drop you into the hearing now with Chairwoman Clark making some opening remarks. You'll also hear from Representative Benny G. Thompson, Michael Jones, who is the CIO of Michael's Stores, and Dave Hogan, the CIO of the National Retail Federation in the United States. There was also testimony from the head of fraud from Visa and the head of PCI, the PCI Council, but to tell you the truth, their comments were pretty dull. And before we get started, I'd just like to apologise in advance for the audio quality. The feed coming out of that hearing was actually pretty dirty. I did my best to clean it up, but as you'll hear, it's still pretty grubby. But here we go. Here is the hearing chair, Ms. Clark.
In light of the rising number of publicly reported data breaches, Chairman Thompson launched an investigation to determine whether the PCI standards have been effective in reducing cybercrime. The results of this investigation suggest that the PCI standards are of questionable strength and effectiveness. The effort to become PCI compliant is a daunting challenge for merchants whose core competency is the selling of merchandise rather than expertise in security. The costs for the largest merchants can be as high as $18 million a year. Many believe that if they complete this arduous task, they will be rewarded with a secure system. But the committee's investigation confirms what many analysts have known for years. In the words of one credit card company, full compliance with the PCI standard does not guarantee that the merchant or vendor will not be the victim of a data breach. Take last year's data breach of Hannaford Brothers Company, for example. Hackers installed malicious code on servers to every one of the grocery stores in the Hannaford chain. The malware intercepted the data stored on the magnetic strip of payment cards as customers used them at the checkout counter. Hannaford received certification that they were PCI compliant on February 28th of 2008. But on February 27th, of 2008, according to the documents obtained by the committee, Hannaford was notified that a number of the credit card numbers from its network were stolen and being used on the black market. In other words, Hannaford was being certified as PCI compliant while an illegal intrusion into its network was in progress. I do not believe that PCI standards are worthless. In the absence of other requirements, they do serve some purpose. But I do want to dispel the myth once and for all that PCI compliance is enough to keep a company secure. It is not, and the credit card companies acknowledge that. The bottom line is that if we care about keeping money out of the hands of terrorists and organized criminals, we have to do more, and we have to do it now. Specifically, we must improve our policies and our technology. First, the standards have to be better because they are inadequate to protect against the methods being used by modern hackers and attackers. Despite what the credit card companies say, for millions of small and large businesses out there, the PCI standards are the ceiling and not the floor. The bar must be raised. In this dynamic threat environment, attackers are constantly ahead of defenders, and yet the PCI standards are updated only by unanimous consent every 2 years. But the part of the problem is that the standards do not require more frequent penetration testing. The only way to reduce breaches is by continuously testing and attacking a system through penetration testing and timely mitigation. Second, the payment card industry and issuing banks need to commit to investing in infrastructure upgrades here in the United States. In a response to the committee's investigation, one breach company noted that the effectiveness of data security standards is inherently limited by the technology base of U.S. credit and signature debit card processing networks. Credit and signature debit transactions are not protected by encrypted PINs. Implementation of encrypted PINs for all credit and debit transactions could be useful. Countries in Europe and Asia are deploying new technologies like chip and PIN to fight fraud that could lead to organized crime and terrorism, and it is working. According to the UK Payments Association, 3 years after beginning the migration to chip card technology, losses on transactions have reduced by 67% from £219 million in 2004 to £73 million in 2007. However, despite card fraud dropping 32% domestically between 2006 and 2007. Overall, counterfeit card fraud affecting UK customers was up 46%. Why? The cards are being used by malicious actors in countries that had not yet implemented the technology. The U.S. is being blown away by security investments overseas, and our 1950s-era system is making us a weak link in the security chain. Magnetic strip-based technology is outmoded and inherently less secure when compared to smart cards or other developing technologies. While I am deeply concerned about our security, the payment card industry and issuing banks should be ashamed about the current state of play and doing everything possible to immediately institute improvements in infrastructure. I know that our witnesses care about keeping financial information out of the hands of terrorists and other organized crime elements. And I know that the payment card industry cares. I know that the merchant community cares. But the time for waiting is over. The time for shifting risk is over. Today, the responsibility is yours to make this situation better. This is the first step in the committee's review of the payment card industry's efforts, a review that I believe the chairman plans to continue. We look forward to hearing about your plans to improve America's cybersecurity posture and working with you in all the weeks and months ahead. The chair now recognizes the chairman of the full committee on Homeland Security, the gentleman from Mississippi, Mr. Thompson, for an opening statement.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Madam Chair, for holding this very critical hearing on the effectiveness of the PCI standards. From our personal computers to government networks to our critical infrastructure, the United States is under attack in cyberspace. This adversary ranges in skill from unsophisticated to highly capable, from lone hackers to organized crime and nation states. Their intent ranges from nuisance and disruption to theft, espionage, and warfare. Their successes are varied from every hacker that we've caught and prosecuted. Thousands continue to work unabated. In December 2008, the Center for Strategic and International Studies concluded that the battle for cyberspace is one that we are not winning. Willie Sutton was rumored to have said he robbed banks because that's where the money is. In today's world of payment cards transaction, the money is now located on computer networks. On any given day, billions of dollars flow back and forth between merchants and payment card networks, which process credit card numbers for transaction in an area that is ripe for hackers to exploit, and they are taking advantage of weaknesses in the system. We are here today to learn about the private sector's efforts to combat data breaches and cybercrime, and to assess the quality of the payment card industry data security standards. The standards have been around for several years, but massive ongoing data breaches at some of America's largest merchants suggest that the standards are inadequate to prevent breaches. The essential flaw with the PCI standards is that it allows companies to check boxes, but not necessarily be secure. Checking boxes make it easier to assess compliance with a standard, but compliance does not equal security. We have to get beyond checkbox security. It provides a false sense of security for everyone involved, and it is ineffective in reducing the real threats. Companies need to understand that even if 100% compliance with PCI standards is achieved, hackers will continue to develop techniques to exploit the computer systems of companies holding cardholder data. You are not safe unless you continually test your systems. Today, we are calling for change. I call on the payment card industry and the thousands of merchants and vendors who have to comply with the standards to rededicate themselves to the goal of securing their networks. For the payment card industry and the issuing banks, this is going to mean significant investment in infrastructure upgrades. As the chair has pointed out, these investments are already ongoing overseas. I'm puzzled and disappointed that we are not seeing similar upgrades here domestically, and I hope our witnesses can explain why the card industry appears not to be moving quickly to address these issues. I'm also deeply troubled by the testimony that suggests credit card companies are less interested in substantially improving their product and procedures than they are reallocating their fraud costs. The payment card industry efforts to shift risk appears to have contributed to our current state of insecurity, and I'm concerned that as long as the card industry is writing the standards, we will never see a more secure system. We in Congress must seriously consider whether we can continue to rely on industry-created and enforced standards, particularly if they are inadequate to address the ongoing threats. I look forward to working with my colleagues on both sides of the aisle and across committee lines to further explore whether government action is necessary to protect against these threats. One thing is certain, the current system is not working. Madam Chair, I thank you for your work in this area, and I look forward to the testimony of both panels.
I now recognize Mr. Jones to summarize his statement for 5 minutes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I've been in retail for 30 years, 20 in retail IT, the last four with Michaels, a $4 billion merchant. I wish I could say that attempting to follow the PCI mandates made me confident that credit card data is completely safe, but unfortunately that is not the case. This is because the mandates have been developed from the perspective of the card companies rather than from those who are expected to follow them. The PCI data security standards are an extraordinarily complex set of requirements. They're very expensive to implement, confusing to comply with, and ultimately subjective, both in their interpretation and in their enforcement. The program is ripe with ambiguity and complexity. As an example, must every company associate acknowledge the security policy of a company? All 40,000 of our associates, or just those involved with credit transactions? This one PCI mandate has been imposed by compliance vendors differently at retailers all across the country. We've been questioned by customers, legislators, and even the credit card companies themselves. Why do you keep credit card information at all? One reason we keep the information is related to another credit card company procedure designed to protect their banks from loss. It's called a chargeback. It can be initiated by a bank on its own, or it can be initiated at the request of a bank's customer. For example, if a customer spots a charge on their credit statement that they don't recognize, they can initiate a charge back by contacting the issuing bank. The retailer is then charged with retrieving the sales media by card number. If the retailer is unable to produce that sales media or something on that sales media does not match, the retail sale is reversed and the cost of the transaction is charged back against the retailer. This is true even if the transaction may have actually been made. This could have been fairly easily solved using a unique approval ID for each transaction, thus eliminating the need for credit card number storage by the retailer. PCI states that all credit card data must be encrypted. There is an exception to this requirement, however. PCI states that data traveling over a private network need not be encrypted. While a private network is more secure, I still would not choose to send credit card numbers through this network unencrypted. Why? Because it adds unnecessary risk. However, the credit card companies' financial institutions do not accept encrypted transactions. We at Michaels have asked for the past 3 years for the ability to send encrypted information to the bank. To date, this has not happened. Why is this an issue? One might ask the consumers affected by the Heartland Payment Systems data breach, or TJX Corporation for that matter. It has been suggested that methods used in those breaches capitalized on this flaw. What can be done to improve this situation? First, many of the PCI requirements are covered by the Sarbanes-Oxley audits. This causes a lot of duplicative work around proof of compliance and is arguably unnecessary. Second, the requirements are one-sided against the merchants. The very financial institutions that impose them are not subject to the mandates themselves. Third, the PCI Data Security Standards Council was allegedly spun off from the credit card companies and set up as an independent governing body of credit card company, bank, and merchant representatives. In fact, the council is set up so that credit card companies and banks retain all power over the ultimate mandates, fines, and anything else connected to PCI. It is not an industry standards body. When a breach occurs and card data is stolen, clearly the consumer potentially suffers the most inconvenience. Fortunately, the law provides that promptly reporting consumers must be held financially harmless. However, the largest financial impact is on the retailer, especially if the credit card company's data, which by and large we do not want, is seized from a retail location. The retailer is in the press, the retailer is demonized, the retailer is threatened with damages and sanctions, the retailer pays the costs of the fraudulent transactions. All of this arises from rules that initially grew from a card monopolist that we have no choice but to do business with or risk the loss of a large portion of our business. We do not need more laws. The existing, sometimes misguided enforcement and proliferation of state regulations around these issues have created a difficult, if not impossible, environment for retailers. In conclusion, I'm proud to report that Michaels has never had evidence of a breach of consumer data. Regardless of the outcome here, we will continue to do what is necessary to keep card data safe. But in the future, we would be more secure and the risks to us all far lower were the card companies to take greater responsibility for the inadequate system of payment they have created and asked us to use. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chairwoman Clark, and members of the committee for this opportunity to appear on behalf of the National Retail Federation, the world's largest retail trade association. I've been with the NRF for almost 7 years and have spent my entire 25-plus year career in retail information technology. Whether it be by cash, check, or plastic, the payment mechanism is really just a means of accomplishing business. Retailers accept credit cards for payment, in part because they have been assured by the credit card companies that if they follow a limited number of steps, they will be given a guarantee of payment. Most retailers are not in the payment acceptance business any more than their customers are in the payment delivery business. There have been two big developments in the last decade or so that have changed the playing field. The first has been the rapid proliferation of general purpose credit cards. With over 80% of the market share, Visa and MasterCard are two primary examples. These cards issue broadly by banks in the hopes that each card will generate income for them. The second change has been society's increased computerization. Globally, there have been numerous instances of hackers from outside of our borders accessing computer systems, stealing credit card information, and then using this data to commit fraud. In several cases, these have targeted companies that process or store credit card data. As with the growth of online shopping fraud, these developments presented the card industry with a challenge. In response, they introduced what they called the Payment Card Industry Data Security Standard, or also called PCI. PCI is an attempt to prevent large stockpiles of credit card data from getting into the wrong hands. However, the PCI guidelines are onerous, confusing, and constantly changing. Indeed, PCI is little more than an elaborate patch. The premise behind PCI, that millions of retail establishments will systematically keep pace with ever-evolving sophistication of today's professional hacker, is just not realistic. Our industry has spent billions on compliance programs related to data security. PCI protocols have required many merchants to scrap good existing data security programs and replace them with a different security programs that meet PCI rules that aren't necessarily any better. Even companies that have been certified as PCI compliant have been compromised. Unfortunately, the economic incentives for the card companies to remedy these flaws in their system have been diminished. It appears to our industry that the credit card companies are somewhat less interested in improving their product and procedures than they are in reallocating their fraud costs. In our view, if you peel back the layers around PCI, you will see it for what it really is, a tool to shift risk off the banks and credit cards' balance sheets and place it on others. It is their payment card system, and retailers, like consumers, are just users of their system. And what is really ironic here is that merchants are forced to store and protect credit card data that many don't want to keep anyway. The credit card companies' own rules around retrieval requests essentially require merchants to keep credit card data for an extended period of time. As I mentioned, all of us, merchants, banks, credit card companies, and our customers want to eliminate credit card fraud. But if the goal is to make credit card data less vulnerable, the ultimate solution is stop requiring merchants to store credit card data in the first place. In fact, we proposed such changes to the PCI Security Standards Council back in 2007. The card industry dismissed our proposal without addressing it in its merits. There have been numerous suggestions made over the years that would significantly reduce the chances of major data breaches, but none of them have been adopted yet. Here are just a few. First, go on record and stop requiring merchants to store credit card data and eliminate any penalties they impose for not doing so. Another, change the system and allow consumers to enter in a PIN or personal identification number for credit card transactions, just like you do with debit card transactions. Third, quickly develop and roll out the next generation of credit card and give merchants the hardware and software necessary to handle these new products. In conclusion, once the payment system itself becomes a burden, commerce inevitably suffers. We believe any one of these recommendations would significantly reduce credit card fraud. Thank you for the opportunity for appearing in front of this committee, and I'll be happy to answer any of your questions.
And there you go. What a spray. What a shellacking. What an absolute spanking. Yikes. Anyway, it's time now for this week's sponsor interview with Paul Wood from Message Labs in the UK. We thought it would be interesting to chat to Paul about some of the new innovations in malware. Now, in light of the shutdown of Makolo last year, a data center that was used largely for hosting malware and command and control channels for botnets, we've noticed malware like Conficker has actually, you know, become quite more sophisticated in terms of command and control and even has a peer-to-peer capability, as Paul explains.
Certainly the Conficker or Downadapt botnet now has the capability of incorporating a peer-to-peer command and control channel, which means that, again, you don't rely on this centralized resource. So you can then issue your commands or updates to one of the nodes, and then that will cascade it to all of the nodes that it knows about, and then each one in turn would then communicate with the nodes that they know about.
But surely, Paul, there's some sort of centralized tracker, right? I mean, you know, we've known this through every sort of single peer-to-peer application in history, whether it's Kazaa or Napster or even BitTorrent, is at somewhere along the line you do have to have a tracker. So is it sort of using that hybrid Kazaa model where there are trackers but each node retains its own list, or how does it actually work?
Well, at the moment, we're not aware of exactly whether it is working, because that doesn't appear to have been activated at the moment. And of course, that could be one of the factors that occurs when it receives its next update. So they've gone to a lot of trouble to try and obfuscate what's actually going on inside the code using encryption technology and also digital signatures within the code, so that it makes it much more difficult to inject something into the botnet unless you're actually the person who's controlling that botnet. So in order to issue another update to the code, you'd have to digitally sign your malware. And then only then, if it's the correct signature, would it actually accept that update. So in terms of whether there are going to be kind of super nodes within the botnet and how they are going to be controlled and what information they will be able to track, I think at the moment certainly remains to be seen. But it does, in terms of the actual botnet technology that's out there, it really is in the vanguard. And I think if you go back perhaps a couple of years and look at something like the Storm botnet, I think certainly many people were taken aback by some of the sophisticated techniques that that particular botnet was then using, although Storm was then very much aggressively targeted by Microsoft in its malicious software removal tool updates. So when you go to the Windows update, then that had a significant impact on the Storm botnet. And I think we saw something very similar more recently with Shrisby, which was affected by the Mercola outage. And as soon as Microsoft started to go after those particular pieces of malware, then that forces the bad guys to up the ante and perhaps shift to a slightly different model that then means that it's much more difficult for them to disrupt that botnet using that same approach.
I understand, Paul, that one of the first things this thing will do, I mean, Configer, in the case of Configer anyway, is as soon as it gets into a system, it disables Windows Update and any sort of, Windows technology that might allow them to eradicate that bug. So, I mean, we were always going to lose that one, weren't we?
I think that's always an important factor. If you're a bad guy and you've got a botnet, you need to try and make sure that that botnet is around for as long as possible, because certainly in the early days of botnets, if you go back 2 or 3 years, they were perhaps considered as disposable computers in a way that were being used to send out spam. So you'd send through your spam run and then you wouldn't use that IP address again. It didn't really matter because then it gets blacklisted. But now they're trying to keep it very much below the radar. So you have a large number of computers, but perhaps not generating as much spam if possible. Unless you have to. If your botnet starts to shrink, then you have to increase the capacity of each particular node, and that's something you don't want to do. So you need to keep it alive for as long as possible. So disrupting things like the Microsoft update or whatever antivirus product you might want to be using on your computer, trying to disable that. Certainly the technology that's behind a lot of the malware, the Trojan software now, is much more sophisticated. So if we talk about things like rootkits that hook very much into the kernel part of the operating system, they become much more difficult to detect because they can present to the rest of the operating system or applications running on top whatever view of the world they want to present. So they can then hide particular pieces of code on the disk. And certainly the more advanced rootkits include kernel drivers that you would obviously use if you're installing a printer or something like that. But some of the more advanced botnets now have their own TCP stack, so they're optimized for spam sending, for example, and they would be part of the kernel separate to the traditional sort of Windows stack that's normally there. So if you're running a firewall, then that's monitoring your standard stack, but if your piece of malware that's hidden behind a rootkit has its own TCP stack, you're not going to necessarily see that. And so one of the other factors that's in terms of identifying botnet infections is looking at the traffic. So something within an organization, such as intrusion detection and monitoring software, would allow you to see what kind of traffic is actually occurring over your network, and is there anything suspicious. For example, a large number of DNS requests may stand out. And of course, then the bad guys will go to the next stage, and something like Zarvester, for example, which is really the next generation of Shrisby, doesn't necessarily require DNS lookups to take place. For when you're sending an email, you'd need to identify the MX record for a particular domain and then send the email to that IP address. They will actually download the MX information as part of the package, so that you have this this file that includes the template of the spam, the addresses you're going to send it to, and all of the mail information that you need to actually generate those messages and send them without resorting to generating a lot of DNS traffic on the network that may, of course, draw attention to yourself.
Well, Paul Wood, I think it's time that you went off and got morning tea and I went off and had a beer. So thank you very much for spending some time with us on Risky Business.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back. Wood on the line from the UK there with this week's sponsor interview. Now, we'd normally check this week's audio mailbag right about now, but again this week, no one felt the love. If you'd like to comment on anything you've heard in Risky Business so that we can play your comments on the show, or you want to suggest something you'd like to hear on the show, you can ring Sydney 02-8569 1835 or USA 877-688-8417, toll free. And we would love to hear from you. So ring up the numbers, leave a message. And that's it for this week's show. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
April the 1st is always a bad day for the gullible, but there were fears that today would be something worse for computer users. A harmful virus called Conficker has been infecting terminals for months, and it was known to have been programmed to do something new today.
Conficker has attracted so much attention that the New York Times and 60 Minutes in America devoted space to stories on it, pointing to the possibility of financial fraud or identity theft. Patrick Gray runs an online IT security news service called Risky.biz. He thinks Conficker has been overhyped.
I think this one's got a lot of attention because it's very big, it's very widespread. I think also Microsoft issuing a $250,000 bounty for the, you know, capture, dead or alive, of whoever created this thing has certainly got the mainstream media interested. But I think, you know, people are focusing on Conficker like it's some sort of acute problem that is, you know, a real menace to us now, whereas really it's just a symptom of a much more serious chronic problem. Which has largely to do with the terrible state of computer security, and you know, and more broadly, the terrible state of sort of transaction security and credit card security online.
And that's worrying Steve Del Bianco from NetChoice, a cohort.